Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and to another episode of the Daily Crane Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Farmer, and today I'm joined by Sara Gong. Sara, how are you doing this fine, what are we, Wednesday already?
Well, thank you.
Excellent. And of course, we also have Michael Morris joining us from Cape Town. Michael, how are you? How are things in the fair Southern Cape?
All good, thanks. It's pretty sunny. It's quite a bit cooler than it probably ought to be at this time of the year, but that's Cape Town for you. It's never really what you think it ought to be. But all good, thank you. Yeah.
Right, so we've got a bit of an odd episode today. The big stories in SA media are all still revolving around, of course, coalitions and the drama going on with what seems to be the endless misfortunes of the ANC. So I think we'll start off with that. But then we're also going to talk a bit today, I think, about China, which is, of course, a very important player in the world. And, yeah, we'll have a little bit of a slightly less focused discussion on that one. So let's start off with the latest coalition news. The DA won Tshwane uncontested. I think that was pretty much expected. The only way that wouldn't happen is if Action SA decided that they were definitely not going to support the DA there. I think that would have been kind of probably electoral suicide of a sort for them. So that didn't go ahead. And now we're set. I think currently the council meeting for eThekwini, also known as Durban, is going on. And it's not clear who's going to win that one. It's very hotly contested. There's a lot of smaller parties who will make up the difference. But the IFP, DA, and EFF have all decided they're going to vote for the DA candidate, which is not good news for the ANC. And if all of these small parties decide to reject the ANC as well, the ANC may, in fact, lose Durban, which is not something I think anyone expected. So one of the interesting stories there has been this revolt by what seems to be the local structures of the IFP across KZN. The National IFP Party announced, and we kind of bashed them for this on the show a while ago, that the IFP was going to go into coalition with the ANC. And then when it came time for the votes, the IFP voted with the opposition, at least in KZN, which I think has which shocked a lot of people, especially the ANC. And so that's, I think, a fascinating story of drama that's playing out. And obviously, probably by the time you hear this, you'll know who won the mayoral candidate thing in Durban. Of course, the only reason they're having the meeting today is because ANC supporters and power outages disrupted it on Monday. So it had to be postponed till today. And it's now been moved to a different venue, and they say there's more security and a generator. kind of says all you need to know about the state of municipal government in Durban. And yeah, anyway, so there's also another story of misfortune for the ANC, and this is about a municipality called Makhondo, which is where Piet Retief is in Mpumalanga. Now, the ANC won a majority in this municipality, but yesterday they managed to lose the municipality despite having a majority of the seats. And you might think, well, how did this happen? Well, it seems that there was some kind of factional dispute within the ANC. Despite winning 21 of the 38 seats in the municipality, a lot of the ANC councillors were very upset at some internal decision, I think, over who gets to be on the proportional representation council list, and so either abstained or voted with the opposition. And as a result, despite the fact that the DA, which has four seats in the municipality, abstained from the vote, the EFF, together with the National Freedom Party, the Freedom Front Plus, and the African Transformation Movement, which is Jimmy Manu's party, managed to elect an independent candidate who was a ward councillor who won an independent ward councillor who won an award there as the mayor. The ATM took the deputy mayor slot, and the EFF was elected as the chief whip of council. Now, I don't expect that to last, because I'm sure that ANC is going to go and discipline its members there and probably fire anyone who it thinks didn't vote the right way. But man, that's embarrassing. And it just shows the total disaster that the ANC seems to be in right now. I mean, we talked yesterday. Terence said that this might be the ANC's Waterloo. that suggests almost like this is the ANC's last hurrah. Maybe actually the creature is already dead and we've only just realized now and all the vultures are taking their turn to have a feast. Let me start with you, Sara. What do you make of all of this chaos of Durban, of Makondo, of Tswane? What are your feelings about what's going on?
Well, what's interesting is, as we've discussed on the program, the IR has taken this analogy of the old buffalo that is the ANC and the calf that is the EFF, and then the wild dogs that are all the opposition parties, big and small. And this, to some extent, is really a play out of that. It's the wild dogs are getting together in a pack, very disparate though they are, and some of them are insanely disparate. Yeah. They're getting together and they are pooling their inner hatred of the ANC. I can only describe it as such. And you're getting these extraordinary results. And in a way, I mean, I think to some extent, although we were, most of us were pleased that the ANC fell below 50% nationally in these elections, you know, one pretty much assumed that where they had the majority, it would, all these positions would go their way.
Or close to it. I mean, like in Durban, they almost have the majority. They're the biggest party by far, I think.
Yeah. And suddenly, I mean, Etiquini's even a possibly, as you say, a candidate for something different. And there's been lots of maneuvering and expectations were going one way and things have ended up going in the other way. And I think, look, I agree. I don't think it's particularly stable. I think these coalitions, you know, each day they survive is another day gained. But it does say a lot about there being a shift, and the ANC is on the receiving end of that, on the wrong receiving end of that shift. And it's probably going to be pretty weird and strange, if not unpleasant to live with, but it is a sign of change. And I think it augurs very interestingly for 2024. And particularly as I heard it from sort of senior ANC elder, the chances of the ANC splitting increase.
And so I guess that's my question to you, Michael. Firstly, I just want your general thoughts on what's going on. But also, when an organization faces some kind of massive setback like this, there's one of two responses. One is everyone is freaked out by what's going on and they pull together to try and consolidate and save themselves. Or two, everyone blames everyone else and they fall apart into even deeper infighting. It's early days yet, but it really seems like the ANC is picking option two. What do you make of that?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, one could think in terms of the wild dogs within the ANC, never mind without. There's kind of evidence of this. I see in the two marvelous last lines of the South African report on the Mkhondo outcome, where the penultimate line says the ANC told the SABC it was not sure if the aggrieved councillors, presumably their own, voted with the opposition. And then the South African report ends, you do the math. I mean, it's quite, you know. So, yeah, I mean, they're facing a crisis, clearly from our point of view, as we see it, it's a crisis of their own making. But it has suddenly come to the fore in this very vivid way that deals are falling through, their own councillors have voting unpredictably, as Sarah says, this means we enter probably a fairly rocky road in terms of local governance, but it does indicate a kind of shaking up of the what appeared to be the solidity of the kind of beer moth politics that we've had literally since 1994. So really, essentially a positive thing. I don't think change in this country has ever really been a placid affair. If we need to endure this kind of rocky road for a bit, that's probably a necessary kind of rite of passage almost to get through to the other side. But it certainly looks like it that, volatility, great deal of infighting, huge insecurity probably in a lot of places, people losing their jobs, losing income, status, prestige, and all the rest of it. Yeah, so I think you're quite right.
So, of course, my thesis, and I think most of our colleagues sort of agree, is that this, the ANC will be saved by the EFF at some point. Then the EFF is simply demonstrating to the ANC that going it alone is not really an option. What do you guys make of that theory? Let me start with you.
I think it has, I mean, the EFF is nothing if not canny. And I think they will have done exactly that on the assumption that these, you know, it would be a matter of time before either a coalition fell apart or they caused a rupture by withdrawing. And they're not necessarily going into coalition. I mean, a lot of the formalities and do not yet include coalitions. Those agreements haven't necessarily been reached. It's a matter of simply choosing to vote against the ANC for those particular positions. So I think it's the power. I agree. I think it's a power play by the EFF because the ANC has got what it wants. And it's
Michael, your thoughts?
I think that's exactly right. If it's not quite a Trojan horse situation, it's certainly one in which the EFF has found a way to exert its influence and to demonstrate its kind of inclination. And I think if that does happen, it'd be up to the smaller parties to steel themselves to, you know, argue that what is now going to happen, if it does in fact happen, is going to be worse for people, as clearly it will be, and that you know, to underline the fact that it's those two parties in fact represent the opposite of the solution,
So the battle for South Africa's soul is not quite over yet, by a long shot.
No,
but this is a sign. I think Asara says that change is in the air. Anyway, let us move on now to a discussion about China. So we found three sort of fairly interesting stories about China, but I want to see if I can tie them all together. So let me just quickly see if I can get through all of them. The first is that the Americans and the Chinese continue to heighten tensions over Taiwan. The Biden administration has invited Taiwan to what is called the Summit for Democracy, which the Americans are hosting. It's inviting 110 participants from around the world. And the idea of this conference is to discuss ways to stop democratic backsliding, the erosion of rights and freedoms worldwide. There's lots of countries that are very explicitly being excluded from this conference. Russia is one, China is another. Some countries which are actually friendly to the United States, like Vietnam, have also been excluded. However, countries like Japan, South Korea, Israel, and Iraq will be there. So it's very much, it does seem to be at least mostly for the most part, a collection of democratic or at least sort of democratic countries from around the world. And this has extremely upset China, which has said that it's firmly opposed to inviting Taiwan, that Taiwan isn't authorized to attend this because Taiwan is part of China, and that it's all an evil sham, and that the United States is, quote unquote, playing with fire. So this is part of a continuing thing we've seen definitely since the beginning of the year, of China constantly acting aggressively towards Taiwan. There've been lots of Air Force incursions just on the edge of Taiwanese airspace by the Chinese Air Force. I think there was an American warship that sailed through the Taiwan Strait recently, just to show that it was still international waters, and that upset the Chinese too. So there's this increasingly aggressive posture that China and indeed the US is adopting towards the independence of Taiwan. At the same time, data has come out in China which shows that China's population grew at its slowest rate since the 1960s. Now, it's worth remembering that in the 1960s, they had a communism-induced famine under Mao Zedong, and that was the reason for the population decline then. So they're now managing to match it without a famine. This is just simply mostly because people aren't getting married and aren't having kids. China last year recorded 8.52 births per 1,000 people, which is the lowest figure since they began collecting data on that since in 1978. This is a drop from 10.41 which is the biggest last year. And this is despite the fact that China's one-child policy has actually been repealed. And I think people are now allowed to have up to three children in China without special permission. So it looks like China is heading for a demographic crisis. Its population is aging extraordinarily rapidly, and it's going to very soon have problems that Japan has, which has for a long time had low birth rates and a fast aging population. And that's never great for economic growth, because you don't have new young workers coming into the system, and you have a lot of people withdrawing pensions and not in the workforce. So that's two of the stories. Here's the third one. And this is one that Michael found on the BBC. A Chinese fashion photographer has apologized for her ignorance after outrage on Chinese social media, which is completely segregated from the rest of the internet, right? It's controlled tightly by the Chinese state. After she took photos of a Chinese woman, which people on Chinese social media sites said perpetuated Western stereotypes of Asian faces. The apology that she issued said, "I blame myself for my immaturity and my ignorance in my past works." And the photographer's name is Miss Chen. And this was after she took some photos for a French fashion magazine. The accusation here was that this was all that the photos she took were encouraging Westerners to continue thinking of Chinese people as small-eyed and devious, and that this was perpetuating negative stereotypes about Chinese people in general. And what was so strange about this is they're talking about these stereotypes that seem to come from the 1930s and 40s, you know, back when America was like at war with Japan in the Second World War. These are not like modern stereotypes of Asian people at all. So let me tie this all together by saying that there was an article linked to us by our CEO, our incoming CEO, John Endres, which suggested that China is in fact a declining power, and that all of these stories are kind of evidence of that. And so the reason that we're headed for some kind of major conflict between China and other countries, particularly the US, is because the Chinese government realizes it needs to act now at the zenith of its power to secure its place in the world, or else it's going to end up declining into irrelevance as the 21st century goes on. So I've laid out a long spiel there, but Michael, let me start with you. What do you make of any of these three stories, and also of the grand thesis that China is in fact insecure in its position in the world, and that's why it's acting out?
I certainly think that that's very right. I was just thinking, you know, I've had a number of conversations over the past couple of months with friends and acquaintances in which the issue of China and the West has cropped up. And invariably, people have the sense, or some of these people that I've been speaking to have the sense of the West as somehow weakened, capitalism faltering, climate change comes into it somewhere, greed, unsustainable spending, and all the rest of it. And then China, on the other hand, is often perceived as the rising alternative, the big threat to America, the likely dominant force of the future. And my argument has always been, or my response has always been, that an unfree society simply cannot respond with the same dynamism, the same immediacy, the same flexibility, same adaptability, same imagination as a free society. And that will always, so long as China remains as relatively unfree as it is, that will always be its downfall. It'll be a source of a kind of depletion of its capacity. It will undermine its ability to respond to things. It'll instill insecurity, which, as John has indicated, is a dangerous thing. It always is. When people are insecure, they tend to act rashly. And it'll always be a society that'll be dependent on a relatively small number of people in the governing elite, the governing structures, to make the decision. So it'll deny itself the dynamism of all those millions of choices that in the free West, in fact, form and create and respond to and recreate reshape the way life works, from how, you know, what cars we drive, what energy we use, what social interactions we choose to use, and how we even determine the shape of those things, you know, technology and one thing or another. And China will be forever denying itself the opportunity of that enormous dynamism, the agency of freedom, so long as it continues to impose its very limited decision-making capacity on that entire country. And in the story about the photographer, you have a terrible, terrible indication of this. I mean, it's in 2021, you know, it looks as though it's something from Zhdanov's Stalinist years, as the, you know, where formalism in art was the kind of great obsession. And you hear, you know, here's this Ms. Chen saying, I will educate myself on Chinese history, attend more relevant events, and improve my ideologies. I will strive to tell China's right story through my work. And it's just tragic. She's a, you know, she's a fashion photographer who's taken a picture. In fact, I mean, this is the other such obvious point, of a real woman. So what are the authorities in Beijing suggesting about this real person, that there's something the matter with her because she has a particular shape of face and so on? It really is the most extraordinary thing, but it is symptomatic of this very great weakness in societies that are unfree and that rely on a powerful elite to determine how people think and respond, and it really does undermine their capacity to be successful. Sorry, it's very, very long-winded
response. No, this is good. So let me kind of lay out a sort of an almost historical story about how this happens. And you can see China's rise as beginning with Deng Xiaoping in the sort of 80s and 90s, and that China seems to get this kind of confidence about itself after the crushing of the Tiananmen Square protests. After that was crushed, the Chinese economy is freeing up and it's starting to grow at this incredible rate. Chinese civil society is actually allowed to grow a little bit, still very much tightly under the control of the state, but there's interest groups and things. There's more Chinese culture that seems to be coming out, and there's still suppression of ethnic minorities, particularly the Tibetans during this time. But generally speaking, China's economy is growing. It's becoming a little bit freer, and its society is becoming more sort of lively, right? It's not like the Maoist years where everyone had to wear gray and smash statues of ancient China. And now all of a sudden, ever since Xi Jinping came into power, we've seen a complete reversal in this. Companies which previously had at least a little bit of independence from the state are being forced to reel in any criticism they might have had. The Chinese billionaires have been arrested or harassed by the state recently. Of course, the Uyghurs in Western China have all been put into large numbers of them have been put into camps. Where we're not entirely sure what's going on there, but not good things, I think is fair to say. There's also been a cracking down on Chinese civil society. I know recently that a gay rights group in China was disbanded all of a sudden, and all of its members had to flee the country or go into hiding. And now we're seeing this increasingly aggressive posture. It seems like the sort of balancing act that China had managed to do of staying a very authoritarian regime but allowing enough economic and social freedom to, you know, make itself powerful, that they've lost its leaders, which have been walking this tight line between freedom and autocracy, have lost their nerve and have gone back to their safety net of autocracy. Sara, what do you make of that thesis and that story I just told?
Yeah, I think the autocracy is interesting, because what the Chinese are discovering with their demographic problem is that the Chinese population is significantly reduced in, as you say, in the early 60s when there was a man-made famine, and what the Chinese government did subsequently, it imposed, I think at the end of the 60s or the early 70s, a one-child policy. And what this resulted in, by fiddling around with birth rates and demographics, what this resulted in was the number of men exceeding the number of women, because it was seen as more desirable to have a boy, and girls would often be put to death at birth. So what you've got now, and coming out of that, is a young adult population where you have not got enough women for men to marry. So that's the one aspect. Because of the economic growth and freedom and the fact that people live better off than they did, is that women are either delaying having children until they're older, so they'll probably have maybe one, at best two, or they're not getting married at all. And the men may not have the option because there just aren't the women available to marry. So all that fiddling within the confines of the authoritarian state actually it did not allow natural processes to find a middle ground. I mean, I know the West is mostly depopulating as well, but not to the same extent. And I think it's a sign that you've got an autocrat in Xi Jinping who, and his devoted Communist Party allies, who are actually, it's an issue they're not entirely in control of. And that would make them insecure and probably make them angry. And they're not quite sure how to deal with it, because it is, again, it's a much bigger issue for a society than falls within the government purview. The other thing that shows, ironically, contrary to what the Chinese say, is the Chinese remove from its exposure to Western society, is that this model, not in Xi real person, but they also they would be the last people to know that in a lot of high-end Western fashion magazines, a lot of the models they use now are very different. In other words, they're not the classic beauties. Mm. They've got unusual features, or they're highlighting. Perhaps it could be what would might have been regarded as a stereotype, but it's to create a certain look and conform with a certain idea for a shoot. It's not making use of a stereotype as such. And this was seen mostly with the advance initially of black models onto the scene. And generally, if you look at fashion magazines, I mean, you see some crazy makeup and some sometimes very strange looking girls. Just they are strange, but that's part of the whole look of where things are. Now, presumably, the Chinese government would not be alert to the fact that that is something in Western fashion photography. So that's the other thing. And with, I think it's obviously Biden would have invited Taiwan on the basis that it knew it would anger the Chinese. Which it predictably did.
And he's in big popularity problems at the moment, so I think he's trying to do something populist. And Americans right now are very anti-China, so I'm sure that's also in the calculus.
And also, it's one thing to purport to go ahead with the one China policy, but Taiwan is a country, whether you formally recognize it or not, and it is a democracy. We'll know that China is about to launch missiles at Taiwan when America invites the Dalai Lama to visit.
that's going to be fireworks.
But again, the overreaction to everything to do with Taiwan, I think insofar as China cares what the rest of the world thinks, the bellicose rhetoric that comes out about Taiwan and the flying within the margins of the of flight zones on numerous hundreds of times is actually I would see it as a sign of weakness. They shouldn't show that they care what the West thinks about Taiwan. It's almost a kind of, we want to attack Taiwan because we want to make it part of China, but please hold us back because we're not sure what the consequences are going to be.
So I think the reason that the Taiwan in particular freaks out the Communist Party so much is that the Communist Party has sort of made this argument through its surrogates that Chinese culture and Chinese people aren't ready for democracy. Democracy is a Western thing. It doesn't involve Chinese people at all. It's alien to them, and it wouldn't work well with them. In fact, that's why they have their Chinese communism with Chinese characteristics, right? Is, I think, their official sort of thing. But what Taiwan does is it's Chinese. It's a Chinese population. It's a Chinese people. It's a Chinese culture. And yet it's this incredibly free, incredibly successful democracy, which per capita is richer than China, even though it's much smaller. And so it's like a great glaring threat to the Chinese state, because it's an alternative model. It says, this is what you could be. And that's, I think, why they're so eager to extinguish it.
Sorry, just to say, I think that's why they went in so hard, contrary to agreements on Hong Kong. Because as long as Hong Kong still resembles a free Hong Kong, it doesn't conform with the Chinese way. And once you've got South Korea and even gradually Vietnam and the whole area becoming more democratic, even that argument, even if you confine it to this is China and China, the way Chinese people think and the culture, it doesn't really measure up.
No, exactly. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. So we shall see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. And I do also just want to say that we will be going on hiatus through December. I think our last show will be the 2nd of December. So that's, in other words, Thursday next week. And we will be back only in January, on the 12th of January. So we hope you don't miss us too much. We hope you'll come back to watch the show. But I'll remind everyone again as we go closer to the final date for the year. But anyway, hope you had a wonderful one. And we shall see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.